nanohub.org.
Mark, we have a few questions here for you, which will be very useful to our students and also to several faculty members in different areas. So the first question we have is, why is there so much excitement about this whole nanoscale vision and nanoscale science, engineering, and technology?
I think the excitement comes when there's anything really new that hasn't been thought about in this way before. And although nanostructures have been known for thousands of years, the name is fairly new. The capability of making them and measuring them is only 22 years old. So it's a new field of science and technology. That's one reason. The other reason is that because they are the right length scale to interact with biological entities, it opens a whole interfacial area between synthetic structures, things we can make in the laboratory, and natural structures. And the combination of bio and nano to give us bio-nano, which is the second part, is one of the reasons for the excitement. The other is just purely nanostructures because the properties depend on size in this regime. We can change size by making different particles. That's new.
So it seems like the interdisciplinary nature of nano is also a key component in the way it's fueling research. So how do you think this interdisciplinary nature actually has an impact on curricula, for example, in chemistry or physics or even in engineering fields?
I believe that science flourishes when the society is interested in the science that goes on in it. And there is a great deal of interest in nanoscience out there. Last year at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, the number of entering students majoring in nanoscience was higher than the number in chemistry and the number in physics combined. That's not necessarily because it's done so brilliantly in Copenhagen. All three of those are done well there. It's because the society has gotten excited about this. Your first question reflects that. I think it gives us an opportunity to enliven our instruction at levels from elementary school through postgraduate by interesting people in what they're already interested in. So talking about chemistry, material science, physics, electrical engineering, chemical engineering in the context of nanostructures. And it's beginning to happen many, many places. As far as I know, there's only one institution, at least in this country, that is purely nano, and that's the State College of the Nanoscale in Albany, New York. But there are a number of places, including Purdue and Northwestern and many others, where there are courses being taught in nano. The ones at Northwestern are jointly taught by people from the chemistry department and the material science department. And I think we'll see a lot more of that.
The next question that we have is very related to you being recognized as the father of molecular electronics.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think is the broad role of molecular electronics in the future of this nanoscale science, engineering, and technology vision that's ongoing?
So I'm a chemist, and I get my kicks out of what molecules do. And for me, the mysteries remain as to how current moves through a molecule, how molecules can store charge, how molecules can change their geometry, and by changing their geometry, modify their charge storage and transport measurements. Something we really haven't talked much about in this field yet, and that is optomolecular electronics. What happens when you shine light on the molecules? What happens when the molecules emit light? Then there's molecular activation. As I shine light or move current through molecules, molecules do stuff, right? So in your body at the moment, there are a whole bunch of molecular motors. Those are actuators, really, in which energy flow is transduced into motion of the molecule. All of those are areas that are just waiting out there still to be explored. If you're speaking about applications, again, I think molecules permit a nexus of interaction between macroscopic entities like light sources and electrodes and biological entities, because molecules are basically the way biology is built, and also because they organize both energy and space differently from traditional solid-state materials, they correspond to a different color in this palette, and that's what makes it interesting.
Traditionally, theory and experimentation have been a very key part of research in any area.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that with the advent of nanotechnology, nanoscale sciences, simulation has started to play a very critical role in how discoveries are made and how they're accelerated. So what do you see as the role of computation in this in the future of nanotechnology?
There used to be two areas of science. There was theoretical and experimental. Now there are three: theoretical, experimental, and modeling. I think it's a fundamental change, so fundamental that I'm tempted to use the paradigm word. It's just a different way of seeing the world. And this kind of modeling can be very, very accurate in certain situations. So the NCN effort at Purdue is headed by Mark Lundstrom, and you know, he's one of the first people to really succeed in doing modeling on circuits that really works. On nanoscale structures and slightly larger structures, that really works. You can model them and predict them. Nobody would build a chip these days without modeling it first. Now, that hasn't happened in molecular electronics yet because we don't understand it well enough. But that's where you'd like to go. You'd like to be such that you could predict behaviors using modeling. In chemistry, this is done. For instance, in the dye industry, if you want to make a new red dye, you don't go out and do a whole bunch of synthetic chemistry until you do some calculations to suggest which dye is going to be the red color that you want. So I think it's going to be a huge role, both in prediction and guidance, building a knowledge base. That's important. But also validating. If I make a measurement, I should be able to interpret my measurement in terms of a model, in terms of a computational model, preferably. If I can't do that, well, maybe there's something new that we need to learn as a community. That could be exciting. Or maybe I made a mistake. So in the area of organic chemistry, one of the great contributors has been this growth of what's called quantum chemistry, where we can really calculate some properties more accurately than they can be measured, and quite reliably also. So I don't think that computation in molecular nanostructures is anywhere near that yet, but that's something we'd like to do.
You touched upon the NCN's role as a key player in providing the kind of tools that will facilitate future research in nanotechnology. The NanoHub is the front-facing side of the NCN, and there are a significant number of tools that are being brought up there by researchers and by other community experts. These include learning materials that contextualize these tools better. Where do you see the NanoHub's role as the front-facing side of NCNS? Is there a value in making all these tools available to the larger community, that too on an open source basis?
About 12 years ago, I wrote a letter nominating somebody for the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. What I said in the letter was that by allowing people to do accurate modeling, developing the tools and making them available, both developing and making them available, this person had changed the way chemists do chemistry. The person was John Popley, he won the Nobel Prize, and it really is true. He changed my science. I think the availability of modeling techniques that are accurate, proven, and reliable, and available, is just going to change everything, just as it did in chemistry. Now, we're nowhere near there yet. The way John made his tools available was by setting up a small company, and people could buy the tools from that company. We've progressed well beyond that now with the advent of grid-based computing and the advent of interactive computing. And I think that the NanoHub is, under the best of circumstances, the NanoHub will do for nanoscience and nanotechnology what that set of programs that Popel developed did for chemistry. And that would be very exciting indeed.
Well, talking of excitement, I was talking to a few colleagues from the informal science community a few weeks back, and I recommended your book about the whole notion of nanoscale science and why is it so big. And you wrote this book with your son. Can you tell us what this experience was like and what you went through writing this book personally?
My son is an engineer and I'm a scientist. And these people, engineers and scientists, as you know, look at things very differently. And Daniel is interested in knowing why and how, but he's interested in quantifying it, getting accurate numbers, making it all work. It's not just a theory, it's a prediction. So that was interesting. He's interested in finishing projects. Scientists very often are interested in continuing projects. That was different. We actually wrote two books. The first one was about a general introduction to nanoscience. The other one was called Nanoscience and Homeland Security, and that one's interesting because, A, nobody bought it. Some people did buy the first one, nobody bought the second one. And secondly, there's a paragraph in there, a chapter actually in there, on the things that often don't get discussed. So that chapter involves problems of the energy, the environment, safety, legalization, equity, ethics, and all the other E words that are really very important in any new technology, and certainly will be important in nanotechnology also. So that was fun to do, and we're thinking about doing one on nanobiotechnology, but neither of us knows enough.
So the last question is more to do with the promise of nanotechnology as a field. Mm-hmm. It seems that every time a new field of study comes up, there's a lot of hype surrounding what it can do and what it cannot do. And I know that you touched upon this in several of the talks that you give. But can you please tell us your views on what this hype is all about and what should we particularly guard against?
Guard against. I guess hype comes from the word hyperbole, right? People just saying something that more or less based on fact but is way over the top and trying to understand what's actually going on. You're giving me a chance to pontificate, and I'll try not to do that. But the advent of the web and basically the whole discourse of media, for scientists is a little upsetting in a way, right? Because we're used to scientific manuscripts are peer-reviewed. And by the time they come out, they've gone to a reasonable person who doesn't know you and who you don't know, who's looked at your work and said, it seems pretty good, why don't you send this out? You can put on the web anything you choose to put on the web. And newspaper writers write under lots of pressure, and broadcast journalists write or do their work under even greater pressure, so funny things can happen. And I guess I'm concerned about this happening here as I am in so many other areas. Nanotechnology can address some very important questions, like energy, for example. And to have people stand up and say, you know, there's enough energy in a quart bottle of ginger ale to power the United States for a month, which is true if you were all turned relativistically into but that's not going to happen. And I think we just need to be terribly careful with these things. People aren't going to stop saying them. And so I think individuals have to have a sort of built-in indicator, BS meter, right? That sort of tells you this is a little bit beyond the pale, guys. This isn't going to happen. So Michael Crichton's novel Prey, which has these little self-assembly carbon nanobots that go inside your body and take it over and cause it to do bad stuff. There are a whole bunch of reasons why that's not right. It doesn't make the story any less fun to read. The story is fun to read. But it's to be remembered, this is science fiction with the emphasis on the fiction. And the concern with hype is that it's Gresham's law, right? Bad news drowns out good news, bad money drowns out good money, bad science drowns out good science, and bad prediction drowns out good prediction. So trying to get the clear message across to society about what we know, and more importantly, what we don't know, that can disappear behind all these claims that the hype monsters have. And that's a concern.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Well, thank you.
I'm answering some questions.